From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, firing top aides, hiding in a bathroom to avoid a reporter, believing top county officials are out to get her. It's been quite a start for Macomb County's new clerk.
She had no government experience. And some people were kind of cringing and thinking, boy, this is going to be a rough road, but I don't think anyone imagined anything like this.
More on Flint's decision to circle back to Detroit area water, the latest twist in an environmental tragedy.
All of it could have been avoided because we're now back to where we started.
Local officials say no to Nestle's push for more groundwater for its bottled water plant for a flat fee of $200 a year.
This really seems to have touched a nerve, that they get this resource for next to nothing that they turn around and put in bottles and sell for a profit.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up, we'll seek the answer to an Am I Curious question posed by listener Ashley Lewis of Royal Oak.
My question is, what is the origin of the Sleeping Bear Dune story?
But first, two environmental stories are making headlines today. First, infected fish in Lake St. Clair. And second, Nestle's bid to pump more Michigan groundwater. Here with us, Keith Matheny of the Detroit Free Press, who's covered these stories. Keith, first, let's start with the fish in Lake St. Clair. What's going on?
Well, there's a kind of a cyclical. It's come up every few years now for at least the last 10 years or so. Fish virus. It's very infectious for fish that's caused a die-off of thousands of fish that people are encountering on the shores of Lake St. Clair. A lot of gizzard shad. It's a silvery fish that's maybe the length of your hand or a little bit bigger. That's the one that people are primarily seeing washed up dead on the shores in large numbers. And this virus, it's known as VHSV. It has a tendency to cause the fish to hemorrhage inside themselves, and it leads to these bloody patches on the skin. So it's pretty a distinctive in terms of when you see a fish that has it, you kind of know it.
Now, do we have any reason to figure that this could spread to other Great Lakes?
It actually has been found in I think three or four of the Great Lakes and in a couple of different inland lakes. It came here about 13 years ago. It's apparently relatively common in the oceans, in our northern oceans, both the Pacific and the Atlantic, and it probably made its way here the same way a lot of invasive species have, either in the ballast water of ocean-going ships that came into the Great Lakes or, through the waterways, the canals, and the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Is there any reason, Keith, for people to worry about swimming or fishing in Lake St. Clair?
According to the Michigan DNR, absolutely not. This is a virus that only affects fish. And if you actually caught and ate an infected fish, it would cause no harm to a human. It's something that's related to the cold-blooded fish that a warm-blooded creature such as a human, it simply has no effect. Interestingly, it also doesn't seem to have an effect on certain fish. Lake sturgeon, for example, DNR folks are telling me it just sort of passes through them and doesn't affect them. Other fish, it gets near them and it's pretty much always fatal. And then yet other fish will get sick and get better and then maybe actually will have some antibodies against this virus.
And again, you say this is cyclical, so when might we expect this to kind of peter out?
This particular event, I'm told, once the water starts warming up, so probably later in the spring, you'll stop seeing it be as common as we're seeing. With regard to when it might come back, that is something they're still trying to get their hands around because it's just so relatively new in the freshwater systems here. They still aren't exactly sure, what makes it crop up and how often we might start seeing it.
Let's head over to Nestle, looking to pump a lot more groundwater for its Ice Mountain bottled water plant up north. And local planning officials in Osceola County said no, but that permit denial is not the end of this?
That's correct. They basically denied a booster pump station that would be located in that township. They denied the permit for that to be installed. Afterwards, the Ice Mountain folks said in a release, and I quote, "The installation of the booster pump was preferable since it has less of an impact than the alternatives of either constructing a second water pipeline or using tanker trucks to transport the additional water." when I followed up with them and said, well, does that mean then that now that this has been rejected, you're going to look at those alternatives, another pipeline or tanker trucks? I didn't get a response. If one reads between the lines, it seems that that's certainly one of the avenues they may now pursue. And the State Department of Environmental Quality, which is considering Nestle's permit for this larger withdrawal of groundwater, has indicated that the township rejection of that pumping station has nothing to do with their process, which is still underway.
Keith, it is worth noting, Nestle is now pumping 250 gallons a minute, and it wants to boost that to 400 gallons a minute. And this giant company gets that groundwater for how much a year?
A $200 a year permit fee, and that's certainly been a bone of contention with a large number of residents of the state. This really seems to have touched a nerve, that they get this resource for next to nothing that they turn around and put in bottles and sell for a profit.
What comes next?
Well, I think we're awaiting the state's decision on the permit. The state has asked for additional information from Nestle about the impact to wetlands in the area where this groundwater would be extracted. And I am not sure yet whether they've received that, but that's something they're waiting on. That's something environmental groups that I've talked to are also keen on learning more about.
Keith Matheny, Detroit Free Press, as always. Thanks so much, Keith.
Thank you.
It's the latest turn in the tragic story of Flint and its water. Mayor Karen Weaver wants her city to keep drawing its water from the Detroit-based Great Lakes Water Authority for the next 30 years. Residents get their chance to weigh in on the mayor's decision tonight at a town hall meeting. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. Daniel, were you surprised at this?
No, not at all. Last year at the Mackinac Conference up on Mackinac Island, I did an interview with the mayor. And she made it pretty clear that she was going to take a very hard look at this and implied, if not outright stated, I went back and looked at this actually the other day, that they were going to get out and they were going to back out of the KWA. And that elicited a letter to the editor from the CEO of the KWA saying basically that the city of Flint is obligated to $7 million a year in debt service and they have a contractual obligation. Well, fast forward to this week. And part of the deal that the city has proposed with the Great Lakes Water Authority, which is the former Detroit system, is that the Detroit system will give them a $7 million credit every year, so long as they continue to pay their debt service. So the net effect is KWA gets its money and Flint gets what it wants.
Because there would have been probably one the mother of all lawsuits had that not happened.
Oh, absolutely. So I think my point here is twofold. One is everybody, it appears, this has to go through the regular governmental processes, but everybody appears to get what they want. But more importantly is all this was so unnecessary. I mean, here we are 3 years to the month from when a former emergency manager ordered Flint to change its water source. And your air and my newspaper and Lord knows whoever else has been reporting on all the terrible things that happened to children and to people and Legionnaires outbreaks and all this other kind of stuff. And all of it could have been avoided because we're now back to where we started.
With much suffering, with health effects that are going to last for generations.
Unbelievable. And a tarring of Flint, a tarring of the Snyder administration, a tarring of Michigan's competence as a state in the way it's run. I mean, you go down the list. It's one thing after another. And here we are. The mayor wants to take Flint back to where it was in the beginning. I think politically, that's the only choice she has. That lingering anxiety of connecting yet again to another water system, I think, would be very hard politically to manage. And it would be a deterrent potentially to any investment. This is, a predictable outcome, but it's so unnecessary.
And as your opening salvo in today's column put it, dumb management and even dumber politics.
Oh, yeah. You know, the emergency management law has been criticized for the root of this problem. I dissent from that a little bit. I think it's not the law. It's the people who were chosen. You know, if you look at the Detroit bankruptcy, when the governor decided to bring in Kevin Orr, he brought in somebody who was a professional from outside. He was not part of the Detroit political ecosystem. And some listeners may remember that some of the names being floated at the time were people who were well known in the Detroit political system. Kevin Orr came in and he had a job to do. He worked for the governor and he was empowered by state law, period. That's not what happened in Flint. You had four different emergency managers, all of whom came from the political ecosystem of Flint. What does that mean? That means you have alliances, you have allies, you have enemies. And as a result, I think some decisions were made that weren't necessarily in the best interest of the city, and they didn't look at what some of the implications were. And so here we are, and now all of it's being unwound.
Do you get a sense, Daniel, that the public is sort of numb over all of this?
It depends on your definition of numb. I think those of us who don't live there, absolutely. I think people have moved on, and this is just an afterthought. I mean, if you're really politically minded, particularly, I think, Democrats, you see this as a club to beat Republicans with. And frankly, Republicans have given them that club, and they're able to use this. Nationally, I think this reinforces, unfortunately, a narrative about some of the major cities in Michigan, Detroit, Flint being two examples, which, of course, are minority-majority cities. And that is the relative incompetence of the management and governance of those cities. I've always noted that there's a sense of superiority. Look down the nose at these people who really can't take care of their own affairs. And unfortunately, this has reinforced that. It's not fair, but it is reality. And when we complain about people picking on Michigan or picking on Detroit or picking on Flint, it's these kinds of things that give critics ammunition. And as long as people keep making these kind of mistakes, people will continue to pick at these cities and this state because we give them the ammunition to do so.
And people from the outside not grasping the reality that the decision was made by an emergency manager appointed by the governor, not by the locals.
I think that's right, you know, and that's how it works. But I think a lot of, you know, they say in the context of presidential administrations that personnel is policy and personnel is destiny. And I think that applies here as well. If you look at the emergency management system and what has worked in Michigan and what has abysmally failed, a lot of it has been driven by who the people were that were making the decisions.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howells. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
And a reminder, we will be at the Flint Institute of Arts on this Saturday evening. I'm hoping you'll join me. You can be part of the live audience for the show. Learn more on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Still to come, we'll look at the role of laughter in maintaining your mental health.
When you start laughing, everybody around you start laughing. So it's very infectious. It can be very bonding and relationship building.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Candy. Want to improve and even protect your mental health? Then go ahead and laugh. Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farha Abbasi is with us now. Dr. Abbasi, that old adage, laughter is the best medicine, there really is truth in that, isn't there?
Absolutely, Cindy. We are realizing not only we have mental benefits of laughing, but there are physical effects that enhance your body's well-being. So if you think when you are laughing, your whole body is relaxed, your stress cuts down, your diaphragm is the muscle that helps you breathe. So your diaphragm is relaxed, so more oxygen is going to your body and your brain. So you are thinking better, you are functioning better. Long term, they have seen it might even improve your immunity.
Do I understand when we laugh, it can actually, you know, help pump up some really good chemicals in our brains throughout our bodies?
Absolutely. Natural endorphins are released, which are your good mood hormones. Your serotonin is up. You are feeling relaxed. Your muscles are relaxed. So overall, it's a great and a very simple way to bring your mood up.
Well, and you're absolutely right. It's free. There's no harmful side effects from a good laugh.
Absolutely. As long as it's meant with good intent and you're not laughing at someone else, then yes, no side effects.
Am I right that this seems to be a really high stress time for many people?
Absolutely. And there is a lot of literature now talking about positive psychology, which is like, how about instead of focusing on what's going wrong, even if we can take a few minutes in our work hours or in our day to step back and focus on what is working, what's positive happening around us, and look at the benefits of doing that. So positive psychology puts a lot of emphasis on humor and laughing and looking at things that are positive, like, okay, you have been watching news for too long and it's stressing you out. How about you change channel and watch cartoons for a while, or see a video, YouTube video of a kid laughing? Things like that can actually put your mind in a completely different frame.
You know, there's got to be a reason that whenever somebody tweets out a funny cat video or post it on Facebook, that it's shared immediately. You just see that there. In fact, I follow Emergency Kittens on Twitter for that very reason, because you're always going to get a smile with a cat picture or a cat video. What should we not do in this laughter? Because you've said laughter can be self-enhancing or it can be self-defeating.
So we have to be very careful, because it's different when you are laughing at a situation to diffuse stress. But if you turn it into a self-deprecating or self-defeating humor, it's almost like then you are becoming bitter and angry and cynic. And then that fails the purpose. So it's about, I'm human, I'm not perfect, I will make mistakes, things happen. It's more, the positive humor is more about acceptance of, okay, this is my reality, what am I going to do with it? So it's more of an acceptance, while self-deprecating or self-defeating humor is more putting yourself down. Mm-hmm. Instead of building your self-esteem, it's just going to bring you down more, make you more bitter and angry.
It sounds like the difference between taking yourself too seriously and not taking yourself seriously and being able to realize, hey, we're all human.
Absolutely.
Now, you've had experiences, have you not, Dr. Abbasi, as an immigrant? Sometimes it's got to be a feeling of kind of stumbling around in this new country and figuring things out. And that's certainly stressful. But where have you seen, what have you experienced where humor helped you?
Oh, I always talk about laughing all the way. I mean, I wouldn't have survived if I did not have this instinct to be able to laugh at the situations instead of internalizing it and making it about inadequacy, not knowing the system. I just decided to laugh about things. And I will give you a few examples, Cindy. So I was at this party and somebody served me this beautifully baked cake, delicious. And I said, oh, how did you bake this? And she said, oh, I baked it from scratch. And next day, I'm at the grocery store looking for the scratch. And I'm asking everyone, which aisle can I find the scratch? So,
Idioms must be very, very confusing, or popular references, song titles, for instance.
Oh, my God. Let's not even go there.
Give me an example.
Sure. As an immigrant, I was moving. I had so much stuff in my car all the time, boxes unopened. So I hear this song, All the Junk in Your Trunk. And I said, that's it. This gets the immigration experience, right? So I'm singing this loud, All the Junk in My Trunk. Till one of my residents pulls me to the side and said, Dr. Abbasi, I don't think you know what you're singing about. I said, oh, it means I just need to clean my car, right? So, and oh my God, was I embarrassed when I found out what I've been singing.
You were not singing about boxes in your trunk at all. And that is the best way to do it, isn't it? And I think as parents, that has to be a good gift for us to give our kids.
Absolutely. I mean, especially I was just listening to your NPR segment about encouraging reading, that how it's important to make it fun and laugh along the way. And always it's better, you know, when you are playing with your kids or having fun with them, to pass on a message. I have seen, even with political satire, we are seeing that when you are talking in a humor, in fun way, you can send some very strong messages without hurting anyone's feelings. And even as a psychological point of view, we know that humor is the most mature defense mechanism that was given to us. But the simple act of laughing, which, like you said, is free, but when you start laughing, everybody around you start laughing. So it's very infectious. It can be very bonding and relationship building.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Absolutely.
Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farha Abbasi with a great prescription for all of us. Come on, go ahead and laugh. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Abbasi.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
What? When?
Why?
I am curious.
Time for another round of Am I Curious, where you ask a question and we set out to uncover the answer. Our latest Am I Curious question comes from Michigan radio listener Ashley Lewis of Royal Oak, and she is with us now. Ashley, what is your question?
My question is, what is the origin of the Sleeping Bear Dune story?
And what made you think of asking that?
I just always wondered because, you know, we've all heard it since we were kids, and I never knew, so just curious.
Well, and that's exactly what we do. We found someone who can answer your question, Ashley. Eric Hemingway is with us. Eric's the director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Good to have you back on Stateside, Eric. You're becoming a regular.
Well, thank you for having me back.
First, Eric, will you tell us this story of the bear cubs and the Sleeping Bear Dunes?
Well, I can tell you the story that was related to me as a child growing up in Cross Village. And I always like to put this sort of disclaimer out there. You know, these stories are unique to a lot of different communities. So a community could have the same story, but it's a little bit unique to their area. So I'm sure the story is a little bit different in Wisconsin. I'm going to tell you about what I learned in Cross Village.
Go!
So as a kid, the story that I heard, there was a great fire in Wisconsin many, many years ago. And during the fire, there was a mama bear and she had two cubs. And in order to escape this fire that was just ravaging all through the forest, the mama bear decided to make a go for it across Lake Michigan. So she took her and her cubs, and they just started to swim. And it was a very difficult journey, and they swam and they swam and they swam until they got into the sight of land. And the mama bear made it to shore, and she was exhausted, and she lay down onto the shoreline, and she was waiting for her cubs to follow her to where she was resting. Well, she was waiting and waiting, and her cubs never made it. Her cubs were within sight, but they just didn't have the strength to get to the shore, and they perished in the lake. And out of her sadness, she became the Dunes at Sleeping Bear, and South Manitou and North Manitou Island became her cubs. So they became a part of the landscape of the Great Lakes. So that was a story that I was told as a kid.
In this story, there's probably no way of knowing how ancient it is there?
It's ancient. It goes back, and I understand time as it was explained to me, especially with storytelling, that time goes in a circle in many Native beliefs, especially at the Anishinaabeg. So time is always beginning and it's ending, and it's beginning and it's ending. It keeps going in this cycle. And it's very different than the linear example in Western concepts of time where you have a beginning and an ending. Well, in our concept, there is no beginning and ending. And many times the event is what is paramount, is what is stressed in the story. So the event was the mother and her cubs swimming and, you know, creating these landscapes. When it happened isn't as important as the event itself.
Mm. Now, I have heard sometimes when people talk about this, they use the word legend or myth. Explain to us why that's not the best words to use.
So when a lot of the Native stories have been translated to non-Native communities, this terminology with myth, folklore, fairy tale.
Yeah.
I really try to stay away from that terminology because it lends to this story not being true, that it's, you know, this fancy story you tell kids before bed, or it just doesn't hold any credence. And I really stay away from that because these stories do have credence and they do have truth for the communities that believe in them. And the Anishinaabeg are, you know, an oral people. That's how all of their history and knowledge and wisdom is passed down from generation to generation, you know, from word of mouth. So when you start to put these labels on these stories to say this is a myth, that starts to take away from the truth that's within those traditions.
Tell us more about Anishinaabeg storytelling. And I understand winter is really the season for stories.
What I was told is that there are certain spirits that are dormant. They're sleeping during winter. And many of these stories that we tell involve these different spirits that are sleeping. So we wait for them to go to sleep, so they're not offended.
Mm.
And then in the wintertime, all these stories are being passed from generation to generation. And storytelling is a very serious affair within Anishinaabe communities. Certain people are giving the title of storyteller, and to have somebody tell a story, a lot of times there's cultural protocols. You have to pass the person tobacco. You have a feast to honor the story in that person. And many of the storytellers will tell the stories in our native language of Anishinaabemowin, because there's words that just don't translate into English.
So I suspect if we could understand Anishinaabemowin, we would hear such nuance to this story.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There would be all these different nuances and meanings and so on and so forth to the story. So storytelling is still carried out in our communities. It's just harder because there's not as many fluent Anishinaabemowin speakers.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've told us that other landscapes in Michigan have their own origin stories, too. Could you tell us the story of Mackinac Island?
Yeah, the story of Mackinac Island is probably one of the most well-known. The name itself roughly translates into the Great Turtle. The story that I was told and I've seen in other sources is that when the world was being created, this Great Turtle rose up and offered itself to be the starting point for all of what we call Turtle Island, which is North America. So that's part of that landscape in that particular area. Also with the Porcupine Mountains, the story I was told that there was once a giant porcupine and he was roaming through the Upper Peninsula and he laid down to rest and he became the Porcupine Mountains.
Okay.
And a lot of these stories also have not just the creation of the landscape, but there's a lot of moral, you know, teachings is what we call them, associated with the stories.
I'd wondered about that. So what would be some of the deeper teachings in the Sleeping Bear Dune story?
Well, a lot of that is through what the person hears. And what I heard as a child is the compassion of parents for their children. You know, they would do anything for their kids. They'd go above and beyond for their children, you know, taking care of them, removing them from dangerous situations. Even though, you know, it's a difficult journey, you still stay together as a family. And you wait for your family, even though you may have reached the destination before them. So that's what I gathered as a kid. And different people will pick up different types of those teachings out of these stories.
And hearing them again and again, I'm gathering you started hearing them as a very little boy.
Started hearing them, yeah, as a young boy. And I think what makes it even more powerful is that, you know, we visit the places where this occurred. So you can go to the Sleeping Bear Dunes, and you're hearing that story about the mother bear and the cubs, and you're seeing the island, you're seeing the cubs. And you're like part of that living landscape as the story is being told to you. It's a very powerful experience. And I would like to add that the area itself goes beyond the story of the bears. I was told a story about Sleeping Bear Dunes by an elder from this community that recently walked on. His name is Simon Otto. And I was talking with Simon a few years ago, and he just brought up Sleeping Bear out of the blue. And he said, do you know the story? I go, about the mother bear? He goes, no, the other story. I go, no, you know, please tell me, Simon. And he said when he was a young boy, they would have other young boys go down to the dunes. And it was a test of, I guess, a rite of passage, so to speak, that these young guys would have to run up the dune without stopping. That was one of your tests of manhood. And he said, you know, some kids couldn't make it, and it would take them several tries, or they come back the next year. And once they did that, they felt accomplished, and they were, you know, considered a young man in the community. So I'd never heard that story from anybody but Simon, and I asked if he ran up the dunes. He said, of course I did. And then he asked me, he goes, Eric, have you run up the dunes? I'm like, no, I've never. He goes, well, there's you know, it's never too late to be a man. So I was like, I got to run up the dunes for Simon. And one more point I want to make about that area within Leelanau, and that is there was a lot of movement in the 1800s of Anishinaabek throughout the state. And in the 1830s, the United States was very animate about not moving. They wanted Native communities to be settled, be permanent. And there was a community under Chief Wakazu from Little Traverse here. And they would go down to Allegan County for the winter, and then they'd go back north in the summer. Well, when they had to make a decision about where to stay permanently, they said, we're going to live in Allegan County. And it became known as Old Wing Mission. Well, after about 10 years there, they decided that, you know, we don't want to be permanently located here in Allegan County. We want to be back up north. So in the late 1830s, they decided that they're going to choose a permanent location on the Leelanau Peninsula, right next to Sleeping Bear. And as they were leaving their location at Allegan County, they were packing up all their goods and all their families. And the one thing that they made sure that they took with them was all of their dead. They went and disinterred all of their relatives that had passed away, wrapped them up, packed them in the canoes, and brought them with them up north to Leelanau and reburied them next to where they lived. So they chose a very special place, obviously, at Leelanau Peninsula, but it just adds another layer of, you know, the attraction or the sacredness that is Sleeping Bear.
Ashley Lewis, what do you think? Did you get your question answered?
I definitely did. It was really interesting.
Yeah, there's really a lot to peel away and unpack with this. And I guess we could score another answer for Am I Curious? So we want to thank you so very much, Eric Hemenway with the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, and Michigan radio listener Ashley Lewis. We're glad you wrote in. We all learned something, Ashley. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
We spoke with Eric Hemenway about these stories at the end of winter when snow was still on the ground and the spirits were sleeping. If you have a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, you can send it along by going to the Am I Curious link at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. It has been a strange start for Macomb County's new clerk.
She believes that the county board of commissioners, the county attorneys, county executive Mark Hackle, are all out to get her and to ruin her.
Coming up next, we'll get an update from longtime Macomb County reporter Chad Selweski on this very interesting story. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been a rocky first few months in office, to say the least, for the new Macomb County Clerk Register of Deeds, Karen Spranger, and her staff. Last night, the County Ethics Board met to discuss ethics complaints filed by a former top aide, someone Spranger fired not long after taking office. The meeting ended with a $100 fine against Spranger for ethics violations, a fine she intends to appeal. But this is just scratching the surface of what's been going on since she was elected last November. With us, longtime Macomb County reporter Chad Selweski. Chad, this meeting last night is just a little twist in a long voyage here, isn't it?
Yeah, Karen Spranger has gotten off to a really rocky start, only been in office a little over 3 months. She's had a whole series of issues, misuse of the county computer system. Employees have publicly said that she's created a hostile work environment. She tends to make some unusual decisions, like firing her two top aides after less than 3 months. These are appointees that she praised up and down when she brought them in. And I think that her lack of transparency is probably the overriding issue. She didn't really explain very well why she fired the two appointees. She didn't really discuss in detail why she was letting people use the computer system who were not authorized to. And then we had this bizarre situation last week where a TV news reporter tried to question her at the county administration building.
Yeah, and didn't she run in and hide in a bathroom?
Yeah, she ran and hid in the bathroom. Then she went down six flights of stairs to try and lose this TV crew. Her newest appointee was alongside her and called 911, had the police come out. The TV crew was still trying to question her in the parking structure when the deputies arrived. On the 911 call, they said that there was a flock of reporters harassing her. When the deputies got there, it turns out it was just one reporter.
And well within her rights to be able to approach and question a public official in a public place.
Yeah, the police report said that the deputies had to explain to her that the press is within their constitutional rights to be on the premises of a public building and request comments from public employees. It's kind of bizarre that an elected official would have to have something like that explained to them.
And all of this kind of going on, I mean, I know there are, you know, the two fired employees have filed suits and ethics complaints, and I know the county commissioners approved hiring a couple of attorneys to represent the county and Spranger, and what, $200,000 price tag for taxpayers?
Yeah, she insists on using her own attorney rather than using the county attorneys, and the definite implication there is she doesn't trust the county attorneys. She believes that the county board of commissioners, the county attorneys, county executive Mark Hackle are all out to get her and to ruin her.
This must be shocking for people in Macomb County after 20 years of a well-run office from the previous county clerk.
Yeah, well-run office is actually putting it mildly. The office under former clerk Carmela Sabah was like way ahead of the curve on a number of things. They put in place a number of new programs and services that were first in the state of Michigan, in a couple of cases first in the nation, and they had won a whole slew of national awards. And then one of Spranger's assistants, shortly after she took office, suggested that the office was not up to speed and needed to be reorganized.
And we also know she wanted $15,000 to, what was this, to she asked for permission to pay $15,000 for an independent counsel for her to, in her words, displace, reassign, or demote unionized employees.
Yeah, she was under the impression for some reason that she could fire a number of unionized employees who were obviously working under a contract. And when that was explained to her that you can't do that, she wouldn't back down. She's proposed a number of things that other county officials have tried to get her to back away from, and she won't do it. The latest I'm hearing is that in the Register of Deeds office, you know, she's the clerk and Register of Deeds, Register of Deeds office where all the real estate transactions are recorded and stored, I'm hearing that there's some serious problems over there. And that could end up being a really serious matter because, you know, you're talking about property rights and perhaps a swarm of lawyers swooping in if things aren't done properly there.
Chad, in a nutshell, has anyone seen anything like this in Macomb County government?
No. When she was first elected, people were stunned. She was very narrowly elected. And her basic history is as a political gadfly. She had no government experience. And so people were kind of cringing and thinking, boy, this is going to be a rough road. But I don't think anyone imagined anything like this.
Chad Selwesky, longtime Macomb County reporter. Thanks for the update, Chad.
Okay, thank you.
And if you miss our show on the radio, it's very easy to catch us on iTunes. Just search for Stateside, and while you're there, give us a review. We'd like to hear what you think.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
You've got a career humming along in super cool Brooklyn, and then out of the blue come two job offers, one in Paris, including a rooftop apartment, the other in Ann Arbor. Which offer wins out? Dawn Verbrugge had to make that choice, and the fact that she is sitting across the table from me right now here in Ann Arbor means we know which one won. Dawn, welcome. Good to have you
here.
Thank
you. Thank you for having me.
So you grew up in the Upper Peninsula, and you did your undergrad at U of M.
Yes.
So you were not unfamiliar with Michigan, but you'd been gone a while, hadn't you?
Right. So after I graduated from here, I moved to Southern California and then up to San Francisco, as you do when you work in tech. I went to graduate school in New York, so that transferred me across the country, and I just fell in love with the city of New York and stayed there, fell in love with a man working at the United Nations, so we spent a year in the Middle East and then moved back to New York.
And you were in Brooklyn, working in Brooklyn? What were you
living
doing?
Living in Brooklyn, working in Manhattan as the head of marketing at a technology company. That's sort of my gig, right, the head of marketing at technology companies. I was also at the same time teaching as an adjunct at the New School University at Parsons School of Design. And I'd been teaching there for about 7 years in what's called their design management program. And I was management faculty there. And they had asked if I wanted to run the management program in Paris.
Oh, boy. So there's your offer behind door number one, a job in Paris, which I understand came with a rooftop apartment near the Louvre.
2 blocks from the Louvre, yeah.
Oh, boy. And then behind door number two comes an offer to join a company in Ann Arbor called Nutshell. Doing what?
So first of all, let me tell you how the offer came through. Yeah. So it came as an email from a recruiter. And the subject line said, VP marketing at a CRM company. And CRM is a technology that I happen to really love. In Ann Arbor.
What is CRM?
CRM stands for Customer Relationship Management Software. It's really software that helps sales reps manage their deals, right, and track the deals they're working on.
Okay.
I thought, well, this is interesting. I forwarded it to my husband, and all I said was, this was interesting. And by the time I got home, he had been researching the school district, and he was fairly sold on Ann Arbor, even though we knew we already had this Paris opportunity.
And then you came out and took a look at the job.
Yeah, then I came out and took a look at the job. The CEO was smart in that he recognized the sort of single biggest question I had, which was, if I move to Ann Arbor and this doesn't work out, am I effectively ending my career? Where do I go from there? So he actually took me around to some of the other technology companies here in Ann Arbor to give me some comfort that there were other opportunities. And what I saw in Ann Arbor is this really sort of nascent but burgeoning technology community. Mm-hmm. And it was something that, as an entrepreneur, it's something I like to grow things, and I could see that this was an entire community that was ready for growth.
So you said yes to door number two, and here you are in Ann Arbor.
So indeed.
What are some of the things that you and your family have discovered or rediscovered in your case as you kind of settle into Southeast Michigan?
It was not easy, especially for my husband at first. I mean, I had lived here before. Mm-hmm. But for him, we were, particularly coming out of the United Nations, part of this really international community of friends in New York. And when we came here, it's much more domestic. And that's been something that's been challenging for us. One thing that I've learned is that the university community and maybe the hospital community and then the private sector are all fairly distinct here. Mm-hmm. There's less mingling between those groups socially as my husband and I would like. So we're trying to find ways to make that work. Some of the things have been blissful. We no longer have to push a stroller up and down stairs to the subway. We're not staring down $500,000 in private school tuition just to get our child through her senior year of high school. So some of that has been amazing. This is an unbelievable place to raise a family.
What about, as you've been back here with fresh eyes, this fresh perspective mm-hmm. that you bring, what have you learned and what have you seen about the tech environment in Southeast Michigan?
There are a couple of things that have really stood out to me. One is that we have a pretty great pipeline of entry-level or junior technology talent, but the city is missing a little bit on the senior management side. And I think that there's a ton of opportunity here as a senior manager who moved here myself. I think that there are plenty of trailing spouses at the university and at the hospital that we could be reaching out to. I think that people who have some sort of connection to Ann Arbor are sort of obvious candidates for moving back here. You didn't have to sell me on Ann Arbor. You had to sell me on the job,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
That's definitely something that's missing. And without that senior...
Why do you think it is missing? Yeah. Is it because these are new companies and they're kind mm-hmm. of growing up and so they
yep.
haven't hit the point to have that senior management?
I think there's some brain drain mm-hmm. in the state mm-hmm. of Michigan. This is not a secret to anybody.
No.
What's happening is some talent leaves Michigan and frankly just doesn't come back. And that means that while we have sort of early stage talent, we don't have the managers who can come in and really train them. And that's not just at a detriment to the careers of those people, but also for the entire technology community. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, because there aren't those senior managers coming back, it means that there aren't enough people or there isn't enough critical mass for people to be able to sharpen their skills, right? There aren't so many people at your level that you can talk to and bounce ideas off of. And I think that Ann Arbor is in a really great place, but the next step for the technology community here is to develop that critical mass.
Because that just keeps things moving and moving and moving.
You get that positive flywheel,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Okay. So I got to ask you, here we have mm-hmm. Ann Arbor is a tech hotspot. Why should people care about that?
Yeah. Look, the obvious reason, the academic reason, is economic diversification, right?
Yeah.
When I moved back to Ann Arbor, I met a great aunt of mine who I actually sort of never really knew very well growing up, but now realize she's fabulous. She's 89 years old. She got a job in the auto industry in her mid-20s, worked for 30 years, and retired on a full pension, so mid-50s. And those jobs don't exist anymore. I mean, that's unheard of. This idea that you're going to have a job for life and a cottage up north. Mm-hmm. Being from the Upper Peninsula, this isn't something I ever knew happened in Michigan, but now I understand that this is very much the... Yeah, it's very much sort of the mentality around here. These jobs aren't here anymore, so we really need to diversify the economy. Technology is a really great place to do it, particularly with the assets we have at the university and the hospital here. That's the academic mm-hmm. answer. But the personal answer is, if you think about my parents have six children. Before I moved back here, only one of them lived in the state of Michigan.
Everybody had scattered to the winds.
Everybody scatters to the winds because they were well-educated and they moved outside of Michigan. And before I came, there was only one here. And from my parents' point of view, wouldn't they love to see their grandchildren all the time? The fact that my daughter is now merely a 7-hour drive from them is the most fantastic thing in the world.
Seeing this grow in Ann Arbor through Southeast Michigan and then on through the state of Michigan is the goal, the idea. And linking up, right? Because we've got West Michigan, we've got Southeast Michigan, so we're a little bit siloed, aren't we, in this state?
We are a little bit siloed. One thing that I've found that's really interesting is that for people elsewhere in the state, Ann Arbor is a move, right? So we just recruited a great entry-level employee out of Michigan Tech. If you're coming from Michigan Tech, Ann Arbor is the next move. A lot of the graduates from, for example, the engineering school here at the university, for them, Silicon Valley is the next move, right? Yeah. So we have a great opportunity here in Ann Arbor to draw people from all over the state and really build this up as a technology community and then start to seed other areas. And you certainly see a lot happening in Detroit right now, for example.
So what ideas do you have? What's percolating in your brain for making things better and stronger for the startup and the tech community, not just in Ann Arbor, but in Michigan? Take us deeper.
Yeah. So one thing for sure is I think that the state of Michigan needs to be investing in bringing senior management here. I have seen the state of Michigan, for example, recruiting at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin. They were the only state I saw recruiting there. I thought that was very, very forward-looking. Difficult to convince people in Austin to move to Michigan, but I think it was absolutely the right idea.
The presence said a lot, didn't it?
The presence said a lot. I do think that they need that the state of Michigan should be investing in some senior management salaries so that the early stage startups aren't taking the entire burden themselves because they do need to bring people in from out of state. That's an investment we need to make to build up this community. And sometimes people moving in from out of state aren't aware of the local salaries and they have different ideas. And so we need to prepare them for that.
And we should have you talk a little about Nutshell, about this company. Tell us more about what it does and really why it was worth it to you to make the move.
Yeah. So Nutshell's been around for about 7 years, which is fairly long in terms of CRM in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And the company is sort of really founded here locally by some people who, again, moved from outside the state of Michigan and founded the company here. We've been growing rapidly. Our really sort of big selling point, or the thing that really makes Nutshell different, is that we are a CRM built for the sales reps themselves. So most software like this is made for managers. We build our product for the actual sales rep, the person who's using it, because we know that if that person is using it, the manager is going to get better insight out of it.
So exciting. And where do you see the growth of this company? Where do you see it going?
We have a big year. As our head of marketing says, we have impressive growth targets this year. I say aggressive. we have a big year ahead of us. It's a really, really exciting time to be at Nutshell. And that's true of a few different companies here in Ann Arbor right now.
Dawn Verbrugge giving us the sense of her journey from Michigan, all around the country, New York, and then back to Southeast Michigan to be with Nutshell in Ann Arbor. Thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea. So fun. Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Cass Adair. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.